This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Dashran Johan. After a string of state elections, all eyes are now on GE15, which many experts anticipate would most likely be taking place sometime this year. While it's impossible to give a concrete answer as to who's going to win definitively GE15, there's a lot that can be analysed and learned from recent trends as well as simulation. And on that note, recently, Dr. Bridget Welsh, who's an honorary research associate at the University of Nottingham's Malaysia Asia Research Institute, a regular guest on this show and at BFM, she recently analyzed the trends and simulations and came up with some very interesting predictions, important lessons that can be drawn for the upcoming general elections. Dr. Bridget joins us once again on the show to discuss. Welcome to the show, Bridget. How are you doing?
Hi, great to be here as always, and I'm well. It's busy because people are looking towards elections. There's a lot of activity happening in Malaysia.
Yeah, I can imagine, like, you know, you just having to travel up and down the country to try and, you know, go through all various meetings and all of that. Let's get right into it. There are trends, there are simulations that have been done. How was the simulation done, and what are the caveats we have to, you know, the caveats and disclaimers that need to be addressed before we get into some of the details and analysis?
So I think one of the things that's happening in the understanding of Malaysian politics is that we're beginning to use much more data for analysis. So traditionally, people, you know, look at the candidates or the party contest and others. But now I think over time, as data has become more common and more and it is now you're seeing kind of analysis being done and at the, you know, making a sense of not necessarily predictions, but I think that's a very important word that I don't use, but rather assessments.
Right.
And I think so what was done here is that I looked at the results of the last four state elections, Sabah, Malacca, Sarawak, and Johor. And I assessed and said, what if these trends in these local areas become national? So where the local trends were pronounced, I kept those local trends, like in Malacca, what happened in Malacca would stay in Malacca, right? Mm-hmm. All right. Well, and I looked at from the perspective of Johor, what could happen when you had the three-corner contest between BN, UMNO BN, Pakatan Harapan, and Perikatan Nasional in those contests? And what would be the, given their vote shares and given the shares that are in the particular seats, what would be the impact of that in terms of a national projection, in terms of which seats would change and which seats would not?
Right.
And so it's not just at the seat level; it's also using and looking at polling station data where it's available. So there's a little bit of gaps of that in some of the data in Sarawak, for example, and not all of the Johor data, but we do have a sense of what those projections are, and because the sample size was reduced in that area. And then what it also includes is it includes the new voters. So it uses the electoral roll, one of the recent electoral rolls that includes the ARV and UNDI 18 voters to see what would be that projection in terms of there. So first of all, it is a national election as opposed to a state election. And
right.
So the simulation is based on state results. And so it's so these things are fundamentally different. They're different in three ways. Number one, and national elections usually have higher turnout than state elections. Number two, we see a situation where the resource advantage becomes more neutralized, aka that incumbency and resource advantages are often more effective in smaller locations, be a by-election or state election, as opposed to a national election where, you know, everyone is being stretched in a particular way. So this particularly, in a sense, it removes some of the BN's advantage a little bit in that context. A third factor that is important in terms of a caveat is that this particular But simulation doesn't account for the candidate factors, like who's popular in those areas, who's going to contest against whom, because seat negotiations have not been finalized for everybody. And also equally important is that we don't have a sense of who's going to be contesting against whom. And those things do matter. They're at least about 25% of the kind of shaping the contest in that particular constituency. Right. So this is at best an imperfect projection to an imperfect assessment to look at what is happening and what. And of course, my projection is that elections are not going to be at least till 3 months away and may not even be this year at all. I don't rule out the fact that they may not happen. But I have a sense that there will be a lot of contestation to try to make them happen. but my sense is that there's also contestation happening to stop them happening. Right. But in this context, we have a situation where the timing, in politics, anything can happen, and it changes the climate and it changes the dynamic. But this particular simulation, what it does is it takes the situation right after Johor, looks at Johor in particular, and says, what happens if these things happen nationally, and what will that mean?
Right. And from your simulation, in which you wrote a fantastic article on Malaysia Kini, breaking down all the details, you found that voting trends point to an UMNO Barisan Nasional victory ranging from 117 to 134 seats out of the 222 seats in parliament. Now, this is more than 2018, in which Barisan Nasional won 79 seats. In 2013, Barisan Nasional did win 133 seats, but those numbers include GPS as well. So why do you think the trend is pointing towards a massive, comfortable and pretty healthy victory for UMNO and Barisan Nasional in GE15? What has changed when we compare, GE13, GE14 and now heading towards GE15?
I think there are a lot of things that have shifted. So number one is that UMNO's been able to consolidate its base. It hasn't won much additional support, but they managed to put aside some of their key differences that really undermined them. That's been one particular shift. The second and perhaps equally important shift has been the emergence of different opposition actors. And the most important opposition actor is Proyecta Nasional, in terms of it has come into the political process and it's aligning itself with PAS, which has machinery in some of the states that it's quite strong. And it has these resources of being in government and is still in government, by the way, many of its members. Is able to actually give it an advantage. We can see electorally that while they have had not super gains in terms of actual seat results, what has happened has been modest gains and particularly a considerable vote share. And that vote share has come directly out of predominantly out of Pakatan Harapan. And it's interesting because, like in 2018, three-corner races disproportionately advantaged Pakatan Harapan.
That's right.
Three-corner races in this particular context is disproportionately helping BN in this particular way because they're capturing younger voters and particularly younger Malay voters, which are coming into the electoral roll in a different way. And then the third thing that I think is very important to acknowledge is that Pakatan Harapan is not a unified coalition anymore. I think that the impact of Johor when PKR decided to go on its own logo was really to send a message to the electorate that the people are thinking about positioning separately as opposed to cohesively, and from the perspective of cooperation. So in 2013 and 2018, there was a unified manifesto, there was a coordinated campaign, there was clear kind of leadership. And in Johor, it was sort of, survival of the fittest in terms of what happened electorally.
Right.
And then finally, I think this is not to be ignored, is that we have a situation where the view of the opposition has changed. Now that they've been in government for 22 months, the perceptions of Pakatan and Harapan have shifted, there isn't that same kind of idealism or black and white in terms of politics. Many in the public are a bit more ambivalent, and some are disappointed, some are sort of fed up, and many of them are not sure about them. And, you know, keep in mind what's happening right now is that Harapan is featuring a lot of the divisions. You know, when Mahathir comes out and talks about Muhyiddin, you know, then there's the issue of forming a government again behind the scenes and people saying this shouldn't be with this partner. And then one of the parties is clearly in a very heated party contested party election in PKR, of which they're also featuring the issues of division and leadership. These send a message, right, that these problems of cohesiveness for Harapan are still quite real. And I think those things, obviously the opposition has to work through these issues, and party elections are an important feature of transition and transformation. But at the same juncture, there is also the recognition of the optics of how this is perceived. You know, the opposition continues to act like opposition and play everything out in public as opposed to reach solutions to issues behind the scenes.
Right. Now, what's particularly interesting, and I do want to get to everything you brought up in a little bit more detail in just a second, right? But what's really caught my eye about the analysis is one of these sentences you wrote, and I quote, fewer seats are competitive, less than a third of overall seats, as voting trends point to more secure margins of over 10% of the potential vote. Now, an end quote. A conventional wisdom, Bridget, suggests that as democracies mature, and let's say Malaysia democracies maturing, and more parties join the fold, seats would become more competitive. So why does the simulation prove otherwise?
Well, it's from a perspective of statistics, right? Mm. And keep in mind that we're not bringing in the candidates and other factors. Right. But what happens is that the margins increase, so seats that were won by BN previously become more secure for them if voter trends work in this particular direction, where vote share is taken from the opposition and from Harapan by PN, then there's a higher vote share that BN potentially could win. And then we see, you know, partners like GPS, who's came so well out of the election in Sarawak, you know, their margins have become much higher as a result of that. So many of the seats that might have been more competitive in a place like Sarawak are less competitive now than they used to be. And I think that also in the context of while DAP margins become closer, all right, there still is a considerable differences in some of the seats that DAP has, where you see kind of these old traditional patterns of, because fundamentally, right, what the opposition was able to do in 2018 in particular was to be able to win support across different ethnic communities,
right,
and to be a bridge, right? And keep in mind that most of the seats in Malaysia are mixed seats in some form. And so now when you have these kind of splintering of different votes in one particular community, and you don't have the same kind of, and you have three-corner fights, then it gives a structural advantage to those that control the most. So therefore, less seats become more competitive. Mm. Now, this could change if the opposition begins to offer a different narrative, you know, and begins to organize and figuring out how they're going to strategically position themselves for the election. But a part of that is that they need to be starting to position themselves for what they do in government and what would be the issues in government. Because, you know, this next election, it's not just about who wins power. Right. Of course, our politicians are thinking along those lines. The next election for Malaysia is going to be pivotal in deciding the direction for the country in terms of managing issues of governance and also managing the economic recovery. And, you know, will, for example, there be a return to the goods and service tax, or will there be different tax regime? What sort of issues of social security safety net will be in place? What are the policies in place that will be involved in terms of addressing the legacies of revenue problems that have been exacerbated by issues of corruption? These issues are really fundamental, as Malaysia is in a much less competitive and regional environment and what with greater uncertainty. And I think, those types of discussions have yet to evolve from, because everyone's focused on, you know, will I win this seat? Will I win that seat? Who should I work with? Oh, I really don't like that person. And other things that are very, political navel gazing.
Right. Absolutely. And very toxic as well. Bridget, you know, you brought up the ethnic split, like, you know, splintering among ethnic communities, let's say Chinese, some might want to vote for MCA, some might want to vote for DAP and so on and so forth. Why has Pakatan's Harapan support eroded among non-Malay voters, specifically, let's say, Chinese and Indian voters? We all remember, you know, Najib's infamous Chinese tsunami remark from many years ago, implying that, you know, Chinese and perhaps even other non-Malays have switched their allegiance to the opposition completely, or at least just across the board, especially switching their allegiance towards Pakatan Harapan. Are Chinese and other non-Malays moving back towards Barisan Nasional? How do you read it?
I think the data shows in both Malacca and Johor that the Indian support has swung the most in terms of back to Pakatan, back to BN, and even some moving towards PN. Right. I think the reasons for that are twofold. Number one is that Indian community has been really quite hard hit by COVID, and in some ways they don't have the same access to social protections compared to some of the poorer Malay communities, and because there are imbalances in terms of engagement with different communities on social policies. So the implications of that is that they're looking for greater financial security, of which they did not see that coming from a Harapan government in that area. And that's the second issue, is that more fundamentally, Pakatan Harapan, while there were many issues that they did raise to address the issues, concerns of the Indian community, such some issues like statelessness and others, the fact is that they didn't feature prominently among the different policy initiatives. And this was one of the biggest strategic problems of Harapan, and there are multiple, but one of those is that, you know, you see that they didn't choose to have a politics of their base. You know, from the onset when Mahathir came into office, he continued to be obsessed with Malay support, which was not their political base. They right. only won a quarter of Malay support, but they won 90% of Chinese support and 70% of the Indian support, and in some places even higher in some seats. And they didn't do anything in there. They did very little in their coalition to address the concerns of these particular voters. And I think that, you know, they didn't consolidate their political base.
Right.
And in part because this was not the base that Mahathir ever saw, you know, as prime minister. The parties did, DAP, PKR, and others. And it wasn't as if they weren't attempts to try to address some of these issues, because those were very much on the agenda. And I think a lot of the things that happened subsequently, like the minimum wage, was all put through initially in a Harapan government. But the fact is that the perceptions on the ground were that these promises, like the UEC, for example, were not delivered during the Harapan time. And equally important, they were not delivered. There was a sense that the communities that put a lot of support for them, did not feature prominently in the policy agendas, and I think of all the communities that perhaps felt the most ignored was the Indian community, and I think that's why we see quite a significant swing. We do not see as much of a swing among the Chinese. I think the biggest place where we've seen a swing in Chinese vote was in the Sarawak state election.
Right.
And a lot of that had to be driven by local factors. What is happening among the Chinese voters is that there are a large share of them that are not coming back to vote. So they're disappointed with everyone. And we see this often, right? We saw this in 2018, where Malays just didn't come to vote because they couldn't vote for the opposition, for Harapan at the time, but they wouldn't vote for BN at the time either. So they stayed home. So we see we see some of that happening among some Chinese voters. And it's not, and part of it is disappointment, but part of it, a lot of it is for us, many, for some of them, is there's fatigue, right? There's a sense that things are going on, that they're just not happy with any of the alternatives. But Chinese support has dropped, about 10%. And that is, it's a significant amount when you keep in mind that in 2018, many of the seats were won by very close margins. So therefore, this impacts the results.
On the show with me today is Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia's Asia Research Institute. After the break, we discuss Perikatan Nasional and PKR. We'll be back with more on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia's Asia Research Institute. And Dr. Bridget sharing some insights on a simulation done recently, which suggests a comfortable victory for UMNO BN in JE15. So, Bridget, I'm very curious about Perikatan Nasional because despite its poor performance in governance and in government under Prime Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin, we remember the anti-Muhyiddin protests. Eventually, he was forced to resign after like some political maneuvering and whatnot. How have they still remained incredibly relevant, especially amongst young Malays and younger voters who are, you know, many of them who are, you know, given the option between Pakatan Harapan and Perikatan Nasional, many of them are choosing Perikatan Nasional. How has Perikatan Nasional remained relevant?
Okay, so there are a few things here that I think are really interesting to think about. Mm. The critical years of the age of 16 to like 21, most studies will tell you that these are really critical years for what we call political socialization, how they think about politics. So for many of these younger voters, some that are coming in as 18, others that are, have potentially the right to vote twice, their connection with politics is not, is immediately around GE 14 of 2018.
Right.
So they remember, they think about the Sheraton move. So they remember all the politics of I've got the numbers. They think about,
right.
And then they remember a terrible pandemic, which is still ongoing, by the way. Mm-hmm. But a pandemic which Muhyiddin came in and his argument was that he would increase social safety nets and he would focus on the economy and stop fighting. And he did all of those things, not necessarily positively well for a lot of people, and many people suffered. But the social safety net program was a stark difference than the austerity that the cutbacks that Pakatan Harapan had. And the focus on the economy was, even though the economy was devastated, at least had a kind of mixed effects. And obviously the most devastating impact was all the lockdowns. But the fact is that they were more effective in communicating a clearer narrative, PN was. And at the same time, they weren't fighting as among themselves the way the previous government had been consistently doing from the perceptions from outside. And of course, a lot of that was being destabilized from outside as well. But yeah, it was still a fundamental different perceptions. So, you know, Harappa PN still gets support among young people. And keep in mind that they are there are a few elements that young people look at. Number one is that they're new. So they have so they think about them as being not UMNO and not Harappa. And so they're the future as opposed to the past,
right,
in that context there. And this element, and the second element of that is that they're not UMNO. So if they're not comfortable in PH, and they're not comfortable with UMNO because of the politics of UMNO, they look to something different. And PN has been, interestingly, in both the Malacca and even more so in the Johor campaign, they have sort of been pushing this element of we are not UMNO, especially among the Malay community, as a way to kind of differentiate themselves strategically such that they can galvanize vis-a-vis and pick up those votes of dissatisfaction or right. people looking for new patronage patterns or new opportunities. Muhyiddin was an extremely popular prime minister. I know this may come as a bit of a shock to you personally, but but in terms of the statistics
right.
And the numbers, in terms of the surveys, he was popular. Now, I think there are people who hated him, obviously, as much as there is in any political system. But I think that popularity does translate among some political base and political support. And keep in mind, you know, it was at times where Mahathir was extremely popular and then he became not as popular.
Right. Right?
And I think there's still a lag effect for Muhyiddin.
One would assume the alarm bells are ringing at PKR headquarters because the simulation suggests that PKR could potentially go back to what your analysis says, the 2004 levels of popularity. Why is PKR losing relevance? Is it because of what Azmin's camp did during Langkah Sheraton? Is it the Anwar Ibrahim factor? Or perhaps just a confluence of various reasons?
You start your question in a really interesting and I think a very important way, mm-hmm. which is the role of Langkah Sheraton and the impact of Azman Ali's departure from right. PKR. And I think that few people fully appreciate that Azman Ali was extraordinarily important in terms of PKR's election machinery. He helped to run campaigns and many of his people were part and parcel of that. And when the party, it split, it was a very traumatic split for PKR. And, you know, PKR as a party has had multiple traumatic splits. And I think this is partly because the way the party is organized around personalities that often are pitted against each other in a kind of similar type of pattern. But Osman's departure was particularly devastating for the party because what happened after he left is that they purged Osman people, quote unquote. All right. And that meant that in that process, you were destroying your machinery electorally and you were creating divisions. It was I use the word purge intentionally because it was quite vicious for some of the people that are there. And there's similar concerns that kind of us versus them dynamic is continuing to happen in that party. So weakened machinery, a kind of divisions in the party legacy are there. I think, the problem, again, is that we are now in a different time so this is not a politics of 2013 or 1999 or even 2018, which I believe was very much, galvanized, unfortunately, for Anwar by Mahathir. Right. Now, what we see is a situation for Anwar is that many people do not know of his past. Okay. And what they know of, younger voters only know of what they saw in the last few years.
Right.
And so they think about he's part of a government. He's part of, you know, the man about the numbers, the making deals, right? So they don't think about him in his historical legacy. And so there is clearly a disconnect, especially among younger voters. And, you know, keep in mind that for many Malaysians, this instability and transition was a really hard time for them personally, because the economic conditions were quite significantly challenging. And then they became even more challenging during COVID. So, you know, they don't see him in the same way that, say, the Reformasi generation or people who are older see Anwar, for those that support him. And so what we see is that Anwar no longer has the same pull factor. In some ways, for some people, he's more of a push factor in that context. And so PKR has these challenges in engaging parts of the electorate. And it is in some ways very unfair for PKR, because, you know, in that context is that, you know, while PKR did a lot of the groundwork to build and help to make the 2018 a reality for Harapan, the fact is it wasn't an Anwar Ibrahim or even his close allies government. And Anwar's PKR is getting the brunt of that. But I think there is also a challenge that the narrative about opposition politics or the ability to work together have become problematic, especially in the last year. And these issues, like the logo, for example, it illustrate that there is doubt even within Harapan members about Anwar's leadership. And even in some ways, Rafizi's challenge of coming back into politics is implicitly also a challenge for Anwar's leadership, because you can hear now it's Rafizi's narrative that is much louder than Anwar Ibrahim's narrative about politics. So I think there is a crisis of confidence at multiple levels, institutional, in terms of the public among certain constituency bases, as well as within Harapan and within the political party base. And I think for many people, Anwar Ibrahim is a leader of the past. And Malaysians are focusing on the here and now, or they want something different for their future. They want, you know, they're interested in having something that can be concrete and is going to improve their lives. And they want new ideas and in a particular way. And now there's still some people who hold on to the past. I mean, this is the interesting thing about Malaysia, the Mahathir support, the Najib support, and the Anwar support. But the fact is that the swing voters are looking forward.
Right. And on a separate note, how is PAS becoming increasingly popular? Because your analysis suggests that they very well could win all the current seats, parliamentary seats, and even pick up a few more new seats. Twitter is a bubble, Bridget, as you always remind me, rightfully so. And on Twitter, you know, it seems like they are the most hated party on the planet and so on and so forth. But election trends have proven to be quite the opposite, that they are doing quite well for themselves. What explanation could there be for this?
So first of all, you know, I think it's really important to recognize that Malaysians often exist in echo chambers. Twitter is one of them, right? Mm-hmm. Telegram is another, you know, TikTok is another. People have their own different type of exchange of groups, their WhatsApp groups that are self-reinforcing of their own realities. Mm-hmm. There's little crossover in that context. And this is why it is important as an analyst to try to cross over those as much as possible, to try to understand how different groups are thinking in that context. And I would say, you know, that we do see that while there are real debate within the party about what are the strategic choices that the party should make, aka to work with either UMNO or work with Bersatu, and their divisions over that. I think that there is a sense that we've now seen PAS go into federal government. And this, of course, has strengthened them. They hold three state governments and gained seats both in Johor and, of course, through negotiation in Sabah. So they have made a lot of ground politically from where a situation in GE14 that they did not do as well. Now, what happens now is that it goes back to the same politics of UMNO. UMNO is able to manage its base and bring out its supporters. Well, PAS has strong machinery. It's uneven, like every party, but it's a strong machinery in the places that it has, and it is able to win those particular base back. So, look, for example, look at Kelantan, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a situation like the seat of Jeli. Jeli is currently the MP is Mustafa Muhammad, who used to be an UMNO, who is now part of Bersatu.
Right.
Now, what's going to happen? And he was a potential alternative CM candidate for Kelantan during the last elections. Now, what's going to happen in that seat, in that area? We're going to see Bersatu come in and then BN try to slate somebody. And UMNO Kelantan has always been quite fragmented. And then we have PAS as an incumbent government, who is, while their performance can be say is mixed at best in Kelantan, it still has machinery advantage.
Right.
And so we can see these in, and then what about the seats that they would contest against a weaker Harapan, where there is now a more fragmented vote? So you see, for example, what happened in the seat of Maharani in Johor, in Muar, where PAS won the seat because PN Resources. It wasn't a vote for PAS. It was a vote for PN, which was stronger in parts of northern Johor, because this is where Muhyiddin's base was. Right. So we see a situation where it's not just about their agenda. In fact, none of the party's agendas are really clearly being articulated. It's more about the issues of machinery and positioning of the parties in particular sets of seats that give them their advantage. I mean, I expect, and I'm, you know, really, you know, I was a bit surprised at what I saw in the the statistical number results of lots of seats in Kedah and lots of seats in Terengganu. And this in some ways also showcases how an election could be different than the simulated numbers, right? So,
right.
You know, I spoke to some of my good friends in Kedah. I was wondering, you know, like, you know, my understanding of the performance of the PAS leadership in Kedah has been that it has been one of the most poorly governed states at the state level. But why would they continue to win seats in this area? Because if you saw Kelantan, I mean, I saw Kedah previously, it was split in GE14, and it continues to have that splits, which again advantages those who have machinery, which PAS has the incumbency and machinery in that state now, and it's managed some of their internal problems. But so this is why we see PAS coming and gaining ground. The power of machinery and the power of incumbency are now working with PAS.
Another party that or coalition that has done very well for themselves is GPS. There was a point where GPS, you know, relied on Barisan Nasional. But in recent years, especially, you know, over the past couple of years or so, GPS has become stronger by the day, and they're now undeniable kingmakers. Is this a case of them actually gaining genuine support by the Sarawakian masses due to governance and policies? Or is it a matter of playing their cards right and deploying the right strategy?
Well, they did extremely well. Abangjo Johari did extremely mm-hmm. well, the premier in Sarawak. I think that they went with a more conservative choice in terms of they didn't want to make risky choices. Because, again, it wasn't clear what a Harapan government would bring for Sarawak or for GPS in that context. So they deployed the right strategy, and they also deployed a tremendous amount of resources in the Sarawak election. My general sense is that Sarawakians they weren't given a choice because the opposition was very fragmented and weak. And so what we saw is a kind of limited, less competitive political environment. And we saw a state government that really spent a lot of time trying to woo the voters from the perspective of making traction, particularly on issues involving state nationalism and governance resources of oil and gas, the introduction of the Petronas state tax, that they now have the government can have the 5% state tax. So there were measures that were taken systematically by the GPS government to shore up their position. And those issues will still, as the elections are held soon, this will spill over in terms of strengthening GPS. And what we'll see, interesting to see, is what are the Chinese more urban, Chinese majority urban seats. And this is where I think GPS has got their more competitive seats, such as Miri, such as Sarike. These are some of the seats that are looking at. In places like Cebu, Lanang, these are the seats that I think are going to be very interesting to look at from a perspective of competitiveness, whether or not the GPS can actually continue to provide a momentum for SUPP to return back into more seats at the parliament, or whether or not the DAP and the PKR are able to maintain their hold over these seats.
All right, Bridget, before we wrap this conversation up, do you have some closing thoughts or a final message on GE15?
This particular simulation should be a wake-up call for Harapan to recognize that if trends do continue, that they are going to face a much more difficult political environment. I think also it does show that the system is evolving, that Malaysians are actually looking at politics in a very different way. And the context of COVID, in the context of governance of COVID, which Muhyiddin was part of, did play an important role in shaping that dynamic. And equally important is that, UMNO has made significant grounds electorally. There will be pressures to want to hold an election early to sort of capitalize on that. I think, political fortunes aside, the simulation basically points to a very different type of politics that I think are worrying from a perspective of reforms and a reform agenda because there's such focus on a lack of recognition of that how the voters' interests and concerns have not really been adequately addressed.
And one last thing, you also have a seminar coming up about this, right, where you'll be really breaking down all the numbers and explaining everything in detail. You want to tell us a little bit about that seminar and how people can catch it?
Well, I'm actually going to look at how we think about how Malaysians vote. And there's been, the traditional analysis focuses on ethnicity. Malays vote one way, Chinese vote another way, and they look at mostly ethnic categories. You can see in my research, I've been bringing in a much more variety of social categories, and I'm going to be emphasizing in the seminar the importance of looking at class and social context position as a way of understanding how voters are voting. And this is partly, what we can see in some of the data that the economic conditions and really did underscore what was happening in Johor. It wasn't just about machinery and narratives. It was also about why people sought security, like the Indian community, for example. And so I'm going to talk about traditional patterns of an understanding of voting behavior and what the new dynamics are teaching us. And the simulation is part of that in that it brings attention to data and how data is actually helping us understand voters in a more complex way and be able to understand why they're voting in different ways and to kind of look at different factors. So it's going to be an analytical discussion of the debates and new types of research that we're seeing in Malaysia. It happens online on April 12th at 4:30 or 4 o'clock. I think it is 4 to 5:30. And I will be tweeting the details, and it's also available at the University of Nottingham's website on the UNARI Asia Research Institute. And it's available online. And we're going to have a rich discussion about who is the Malaysian voter and why are they voting how they are.
On that note, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Bridget.
Most welcome.
That was Dr. Bridget Welch, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia's Asia Research Institute. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check us out on podcasts. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.